deal with it. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Let's begin this work session, we're going to call up our task force momentarily, but I just want to set the context. This is a discussion about how the city of Portland might respond if a ballot measure were to pass. That, of course, is prospective and in the hands of the voters, and we will find out in November whether it's going to pass or not. So this is a contingency planning effort, if you will. We, as elected officials, the five of us, are free to speak more directly about political matters than our staff is, but under state law, our staff can't advocate for or against a ballot measure. But actually, that's not really the issue here before us again this morning, is not whether we think the measure should pass or not, but whether if it does, we are prepared as a city to deal with its consequences. So that's what our task force was asked to look into, and want to call them up for their report this morning. We'll have some key questions to get to after their report, particularly the taxation question. I'm going to have to leave earlier than planned, so hopefully we'll give everyone a little extra time, because we won't take the whole time originally allotted for this work session.
Mayor, I just want to be clear. Josh will be presenting, but he is prohibited from discussing the subject matter. So within those limitations, within those limitations, Josh, we wish you well.
He'll be even more succinct than usual.
Good morning. And Mayor, I did want to also point out that our work group started.
Thank you. Our work group really started in response to the question of whether or not the city was going to issue a moratorium on medical dispensaries, which the legislature approved last session. During the course of conversations debating, at least internally, whether a moratorium should be issued, there was a decision made in our office to go ahead and let them open so that we could study what potential regulations we would want to bring forward. And so really the focus throughout our task force was particularly on medical marijuana and dispensaries, with the idea that potentially at some point the state may legalize recreational marijuana one day. But we tried hard to keep to the matter at hand, which are the medical marijuana dispensaries, with this idea that there were probably going to be other issues that would get brought up throughout the course. Our work group was consisted of about 18 city staff members from the Office of Management and Finance, Portland Police Bureau, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the Bureau of Transportation, the Attorney's Office, Bureau of Development Services, the Revenue Department, Office of Government Relations, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Fire Bureau. And we met for several months. We had several sessions with speakers. We had a session with the Oregon Health Authority, Department of Justice, and I want to give a huge thank you to Tom Burns, the director of the pharmacy program for the Oregon Health Authority, who not only spoke to us, but was available for questions throughout the process. He's here, in fact, as well, and would be available for any questions that we can't answer. Tom also was very gracious in setting up tours of dispensaries for our task force as well, which were hugely informative. We met with the county health department, and we met with a consulting firm who had a contract with the state of Colorado to focus on an education campaign for kids. We, after all of our speakers, broke into four subgroups. A subgroup really focused on environmental and consumer safety. A subgroup focused on diversion to the black market. A subgroup focused on diversion to kids, and a revenue subgroup. I'm going to turn it over to the Office of Government Relations just to give a brief snapshot of how we got to this place in terms of legislation.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, Martha Pellegrino, Director of the Office of Government Relations. With me today is Andy Smith, who manages the State Government Relations Program. And we've been asked to provide you with a brief legislative and administrative overview of the medical marijuana system in the state of Oregon. So the Oregon legislature has passed bills in the last two legislative sessions addressing the medical marijuana system. First, they provided some legal clarity and regulatory clarity and a regulatory framework for dispensaries And then in the last 2014 February session, addressed the issue of local control in a limited way. Our office has been monitoring these legislative efforts and continues to do so, and we expect to see some additional legislation in the coming session to address further regulations of the medical marijuana system. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Andy to go into a little bit of detail on these legislative and administrative efforts.
Thank you, Martha. So I'll start by providing a brief overview of the recent legislative history on medical marijuana, and then I'll talk about what we expect to see on medical marijuana during the 2015 legislative session. So during the 2013 session, the legislature passed House Bill 3460, which regulated medical marijuana dispensaries and directed the Oregon Health Authority to conduct rulemaking to implement the medical marijuana dispensary program. And shortly after House Bill 3460 was signed into law, the Oregon Health Authority began rulemaking, and final rules were enacted just last month. Amongst other things, those rules require that dispensaries be located in areas zoned for certain uses, that dispensaries not be located within 1,000 feet of a school, 1,000 feet of each other, or at the same address as a registered grow site. The rules also require criminal background checks for persons responsible for medical marijuana facilities, but not for employees or agents of the dispensaries. They require security requirements for facilities, as well as labeling, packaging, and testing requirements for marijuana products. And finally, the rules set out a process for enforcement, civil penalties, and revocation of facility registration should the dispensaries be out of compliance with the rules. Now, during the 2014 session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1531, which gave local governments explicit time, place, and manner regulatory authority over medical marijuana dispensaries. It also gave local governments the ability to enact one-year moratoriums over the operations of dispensaries in their community, provided they enact those moratoriums prior to May 1st of this year. Since the passage of Senate Bill 1531, 146 cities and 26 counties have enacted moratoriums. There are currently 162 dispensaries legally operating in Oregon, and 68 of those are within the Portland city limits. Also, as of last month, there are 89 approved applications within the city of Portland and another 43 paid applications at various stages of the approval process. Now, looking ahead to the 2015 legislature, we expect to see a number of bills addressing medical marijuana. For example, we expect to see an effort to increase transparency regarding the location of dispensaries. We also expect to see a number of bills addressing the licensing and regulations of various parts of the medical marijuana industry, from testers and testing facilities to marijuana product manufacturers and marijuana concentrates, and for manufacturers of edible marijuana products and marijuana growers. There will also likely be legislation to clarify that normal land use, zoning, and building code applies to medical marijuana dispensaries, criminal background checks and permits for employees and agents of medical marijuana dispensaries, and to make the smoking of marijuana subject to the Indoor Clean Air Act. Thanks for the opportunity, and I'll turn it back over to Josh.
Quick question there. I hadn't realized the extent of the use of the moratorium window that was provided. Is there any significant discussion about extending those moratoria, or does the one-year clock run out in those cities and it's reasonable to expect that they'll start permitting some establishments in a year?
I think the clock has run out on the moratoriums, and I think that the agreement during the last legislative session was you have 1 year to sort of figure out how you're going to do it. Not that we know of.
Can I just ask a question about the 1,000-foot rule? How does that compare to other laws on the books prohibiting location of certain kinds of activities within close proximity to a school, like adult use establishments and other things? Is that consistent? Is that more restrictive? Or do you have a comparator on that?
I'd have to look into that and get back to you with an answer. I haven't looked into other areas where the 1,000-foot rule would apply or other rules like that would apply.
It's one of those issues that we'll hear a lot from the community, and it comes up with adult use establishments, bars, other kinds of things. So I think we'd be interested in just knowing how do they land on 1,000 feet? What does that practically mean? I mean, how far could it be from Lincoln High School or from an elementary school in North Portland? And then do we think that's adequate?
Commissioner, we'll get to a little bit of the siting discussion with some maps from Bureau of Planning Sustainability to look and see, as we add things to that buffer, other institutions, what that looks like in terms of where facilities could be sited. I would also ask the city attorney if they have an opinion on the 1,000-foot rule. We also have Teresa Marchetti in the audience who works with OLCC on liquor, and there are parallels there as well.
Josh, just one other thing. Will we be talking about the question of impaired driving and the regulatory approach to how we deal with that potential issue?
Sergeant Kevin Hogan with Drugs and Vice will be presenting one of the subgroup reports, and you can ask him when he presents. We didn't spend a whole lot of time during the course of the work group on impaired driving because it's incredibly murky subject right now, and we're learning lessons from Washington and Colorado on what they've done and what technology allows us to do, but Sergeant can certainly speak better to it than I can. Great. A couple of things before we get into the presentations. Throughout the course of the work group, there were issues that would come up that did not seem to fit within city authority and potentially could be part of a legislative agenda. We've kept track of what those are, and one action that I would recommend council to do at the end of this would be to direct the Office of Government Relations to work further with the task force to refine any potential recommendations for the legislative agenda coming up soon. I also wanted to say a special thank you to Stephanie Reynolds, who really staffed this task force and put together a website, made all the arrangements, and Stephanie just was vital to this whole process. So thank you, Stephanie. Feel free throughout the course of this to make puns at every work session that we had, at every workroom meeting we had, the puns were just flying, and you find that all of a sudden you can't help but make them. So,
objection. Commissioner Novick does not need any encouragement. Puns.
It is very
in terms
easy.
Of the legislative agenda, I noticed in one of the subcommittee recommendations is a concept of limiting the amount dispensed to 24 ounce of product per day. And I'm wondering, it's currently per transaction. Does the legislature think that that's a problem, that people get multiple transactions per day? And how would that work? You know, I'm assuming that there's some mechanism that doctors tell each other when they're prescribing Vicodin so that somebody can't just go around getting six prescriptions a day. Has there been some discussion of how that might work?
There has. We've gone back and forth on that, and that's one of the issues I think that we want to work closer with OGR on over the next month to figure out what we can and can't ask the legislature when they go through rulemaking to take a look at. I don't know from the legislator's point of view whether they've looked too closely into that. And again, we have Tom Burns here from Oregon Health Authority who probably could shed some light on that. What I'm hopeful that we can do today is have all of the presentations on each of the work groups and then probably start off council discussion at the end of that with a discussion on revenue, because that'll be the most timely direction from council, and then have the rest of the discussion as we move forward. And I'm happy to bring up all the folks from our task force as needed to respond to any questions.
Josh, when Steve and I went to law school, one of the first things we learned was that federal law trumps the law of the states. And it is still a Schedule I drug at the federal level. So to what extent, I mean, so there's a lot of big gray legal issues that we have to deal with, but are we planning to coordinate any part of our strategy with the U.S. Attorney's Office or with federal law enforcement officials to understand the alignment piece?
That's a question probably best answered by Ben. Ben, I don't know if you want to weigh in on that question now.
Commissioner, that's an issue that local governments around the country are kind of struggling with. The federal government to date has addressed that through what is commonly referred to as the Cohen Memo, in which the Department of Justice issued guidance on how, from a prosecutorial standpoint, the DOJ was going to work with local governments and state governments as legalization moved forward, and in, for that matter of fact, as medical marijuana programs were being opened up state after state after state. So the Cohen memo has some suggestions, some guidelines that we're working with, but no, we haven't as of yet had a conversation with the AG's office. The AG's office, or Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office, there will have to be some conversations with them if measure, should the Measure 91 be approved by the voters.
Commissioner, I would add that given the Supreme Court's decision on Medicaid expansion, the new rule appears to be that federal law trumps state law except in states with Republican governors. So if Mr. Richardson wins, I assume that Oregon can do whatever the heck it wants.
And with that, I'll call up Mike Leafield from Bureau of Development Services to present potential recommendations from the Environmental and Consumer Safety Subgroup. Mike.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. So I was a member of a subcommittee on environmental and consumer safety. We started out with looking at concepts related to land use impacts for medical marijuana dispensaries. We talked about issues related to glare, noise, nuisance, trash, litter, all of the common themes that we have from commercial businesses in various areas of the city. We did look into those issues and feel pretty comfortable that the existing regulations that the city has adopted cover most items. These are the medical marijuana dispensaries are operating as commercial businesses and in commercial occupancies. They're subject to the same rules and regulations that other businesses are following. And we anecdotally have not received a large number of concerns about these retail establishments thus far. When we started talking about medical marijuana dispensaries, we did shift our attention to the supply element, which gets into the grow operations, which supply the marijuana for these facilities. That's where we started to have some concerns, not knowing fully the scope or extent of grow operations as they're occurring throughout the city. Our understanding is that we've been told this by PPB, we are not privy to grow operations that are currently operating in the state. These are licensed, approved by OHA, and we are not entitled to a list of their locations. So we have very limited data on where marijuana grow operations are currently occurring. We have had some incidences of work without permit, some elaborate electrical installations without benefit of permit, which gives us some concern without knowing the full extent and scope of how many operations there are. Are they compliant with all the building regulations, the permit requirements, other safety requirements that fire would have as well? So we do want to look into that a little bit further. In studying medical marijuana, we also got into edible marijuana products, which is as a result of a production process using butane honey oil production. Again, I'm not the expert on this, but it's essentially distilling the chemical from marijuana using butane fuel. So we do know that that is a highly explosive, combustible process. We have had some incidents of explosion fire within the city, as well as we have a lot of data throughout the nation where there have been incidents related to explosions for that type of production. So that's something we have another big concern on related to the grow operation supply, if that's something that is currently occurring or may increase in the future. We definitely think we need to study that issue a little bit more. We would land right now that That production we'd need to work with other agencies, Department of Agriculture, Multnomah County, to make sure that that production is meeting all the requirements for licensed kitchens, whatever other rules would be in place to regulate that. We do have a concern that operation may currently be occurring in single family homes. And that's where some of the incidents have occurred. So we do have a recommendation related to addressing that immediate concern. Finally, we have heard a number of concerns related to siting issues for medical marijuana dispensaries. Neighbors are concerned that suddenly they see a sandwich board with a green cross, and so there's more cars at this establishment, and there's concerns about the activity, whether it's noise, idling in the car, just basic increased interactions, consumer interactions. So we did feel that it's important to look at this as a new emerging use with potential impacts, and really treat this similar to how we've treated other activities like liquor licensing establishments and rules for good neighbor plans, making sure that there is timely notification, that neighbors do understand what uses are proposed at various locations throughout the city, and making sure they have some sort of understanding of the operational plan, exactly what will be occurring there, facilitate good neighbor interactions, good knowledge, and hopefully address any issues or impacts that would happen proactively. So the good neighbor plan is something we'd like to look into further. So our committee, our subcommittee, is making the following recommendations. We would like council to consider prohibiting commercial manufacture of edible marijuana products made with butane honey oil in unlicensed kitchens and private residences. One way to do that would be to amend the zoning code and other city codes to include butane honey oil as a prohibited commercial use, prohibited as an accessory use in residential homes as well. So we specifically call that out as a prohibited home occupation activity, and that's a way that we could address that concern.
That's specific about the fuel source. I mean, technology, including in this business, always has a way of outrunning our pace of adopting new regulations. So if the issue is people are using a very flammable material in a home-based business, frankly, whether it's for purposes of processing marijuana or making jewelry, I don't care. I mean, if people are using a dangerous material in the basement of their house, I think we have a public interest in that. We might want to speak more broadly about that in the prohibition about what you can and can't do in a home-based business, rather than hope that we got it right and that it won't change in terms of what people are using in the marijuana business.
That's a really good point, and I think we do need to understand more of the production side of this. The home occupation regulations do have prohibitions on hazardous materials, and so it is already going to prohibit large use of materials. It only allows hazardous materials available basically in consumer grade, so things that you and I could go to a hardware store and purchase for projects we're working on at home, and that's consumer grade. Are without knowing more about the production for the edible marijuana operations, we're concerned that it's not consumer grade, that the amount of materials is much larger. And we would need to work with fire to understand the incidences they've responded to and learn more about the production facility nationwide that's currently
on. Time to work on that. I mean, obviously, soon is good, but it doesn't have to be done prior to November. So.
Yes.
If the time, place, and manner regulatory stuff has been delegated to us, I guess it begs the question, who in city government will be doing the oversight and enforcement, the regulatory oversight piece, and how do we pay for it?
I don't believe we've got to that level of discussion yet. Josh?
Commissioner, it's the right questions to be asking. I think in terms of who in city government, ONI already has a component working with OLCC on liquor, and it would seem this would be an extension of time, place, manner restriction work that happens currently within the city. In terms of who would pay for that, when we have the discussion, I think our last presentation will be on revenue. I
think Thomas can answer that question as well, and at least put forward to council recommendations on what we think we could do to address cost recovery on some of these things.
And Josh, in terms of our current legal framework, if this ballot measure passes, will people be able to smoke marijuana in any place that they are currently allowed to smoke cigarettes?
And he says no.
Yeah, that's not the case. I believe I'm getting this right, that they will only be allowed to smoke recreational marijuana within their private residence.
Under the terms of the ballot
measure. Under the terms of the ballot measure.
Okay.
And I do believe, and Tom can correct me if I'm wrong, that under the medical marijuana provisions, that's also the case.
Just following up on your question previously, Commissioner Fish, on who would manage the program. I know from having been in charge of ONI for 4 years that it's absolutely no way Teresa Marchetti, amazing as she is, could add this whole portfolio to her workload. So there will definitely need to be some more staff wherever it is, potentially in BDS as well.
And Mike, I mean, one of our frustrations with alcohol is that a bad actor, we still have to get the OLCC involved to shut them down. I'm assuming under this proposed regulatory framework, if there's a bad actor, it's our obligation to shut them down.
We have our opportunity maybe to have more leverage than we've had typically with OLCC.
Correct. Well, and I want to separate the current system under the medical marijuana program and a potential future situation under recreational, because the recreational side, we still don't really know what that new world order will look like. Under the current regulations, the Oregon Health Authority has civil enforcement authority on dispensaries. There is an active conversation happening and really beginning now between the county, the city police, and the health authority on whether there should be criminal enforcement over bad actors around the dispensary side. We haven't gotten very far in those discussions yet.
So you're going to walk us through what these maps mean?
Not yet.
Okay. When you're ready.
To get through. So we would like to suggest that Teresa McKinney Marchetti runs the entire registration program. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I had to do that. So we did want to mirror. We do think a good neighbor plan, notification, involvement, neighborhood involvement is a good thing. We would like to mirror some sort of registration program similar to OLCC liquor licensing program that ONI currently operates right now. So that's something that we would like to consider. And then finally, related to grow, we think we don't have enough information to give you good information on whether or not these establishments are inherently more dangerous than other commercial businesses. We just don't know the extent of the grow operations. We would be working with government relations to try to work with the legislature to get us the opportunity to know where the grow operations are operating in the city. From there, we could study the issue further. BDS would like to work with FIRE to form a little small subcommittee to better understand the grow operation concerns. And if there are elevated risks associated with those uses, we would like to come back to you with potential recommendations above and beyond what we currently do for other commercial businesses.
Okay. Good. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Next up, Sergeant Kevin Hogan to discuss the work of the diversion, preventing diversion to the black market.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. So just before I jump into the subcommittee's recommendations, I'd like to back up just a minute, kind of give you guys a little thumbnail sketch of some of the discussions that we had at a committee level, even before we broke down to the subcommittees, that kind of puts some of our recommendations in framework for you. Earlier this year, a number of us on the committee attended a conference hosted by League of Cities and League of Counties. It was held here in Portland, and there was a number of speakers there, including speakers from both Washington and Colorado, that talked about their experiences with both recreational and medical marijuana. And one of the things that those speakers from both states said very clearly is that they highly recommended that states and local governments get their medical marijuana house in order before legalizing recreational marijuana. And I think one of the reasons for that is one of their experiences was that, similar to potentially what we're going to see in Oregon, there's going to be a cost difference between medical marijuana and recreational marijuana due to the tax schedule of both of those products. It's anticipated that if the recreational marijuana ballot passes, there'll be a significant tax on that product, whereas on the medical side, there's not that tax currently. And so inevitably, there is going to be a cost difference and the potential for an increase in diversion on the medical marijuana side to recreational users. So that was a concern for us and something for the city to think about. And the other thing that we really used as guidance when we were doing our work, and Ben Walters at the city attorney's office referred to this earlier, is the Cole memo. And this was a memo written by the deputy U.S. attorney back in August of 2013. And that memo gave some guidance to states that were looking to legalize marijuana. And there were four particular points in that memo that the U.S. attorney's office was looking to advise states on. And those points include preventing revenue from the sale of marijuana from going to criminal enterprises, gangs, and cartels. Secondly, preventing diversion of marijuana from states where it's legal under state law in some form to other states. Thirdly, preventing state-authorized marijuana activity from being used as a cover or pretext for the trafficking of other illegal drugs or illegal activity. And lastly, preventing violence or the use of firearms in the cultivation and distribution of marijuana. So that was kind of, in very broad terms, the federal government's guidance to states that were looking to legalize marijuana. And that was something that we had a lot of discussion about in terms of how we were going to put some regulatory language into place that is responsible in terms of being aimed towards public safety, responsible in terms of addressing the federal concerns about legalizing marijuana, and then also responsible for honoring the will of the voters in making these dispensaries available to medical marijuana patients and having those patients have a way to access their medicine. So that was kind of, in general, what guided our work with all of the committees. My particular committee worked on diversion and theft of medical marijuana to the recreational black market, and we had four recommendations. The first one was that we are advocating that we have a more robust way of tracking inventory at the dispensary level. So currently, inventory is brought in from a grower. It's required to be tracked by the dispensary. But the product coming in isn't necessarily broken out by category. And we think it's important to know whether plants are coming in, whether concentrated oil is coming in, whether medibles are coming in, or some other form of marijuana. And we want to know what that form is and how much weight is coming in for the purpose of tracking and auditing that. So in addition to the intake of that, we also want to track what's sent out for testing. Currently, all of the marijuana coming in is required to be set aside and tested at a certified lab facility. So we want to know what has been sent away. And then lastly, we want to know what tested for mold, tested for pesticide, tested for THC content. The state statute spells out exactly what those requirements are. So we want to know what got sent away. And then lastly, we want to know what's going out the front door in terms of the kind of product and the amount of weight, so that ultimately, if we need to, we can go in there and audit the facility, and they should be accountable for their inventory. And the current state statute allows them a 5% leeway in terms of their inventory, because obviously there will be some evaporation, some shrinkage, that kind of thing. So that is one of our recommendations, is to come up with that a little bit more robust tracking form. Secondly, we looked at the fact that these dispensaries are cash-intensive businesses, primarily because there's still a lot of banks that are reluctant to do business with medical marijuana facilities because, obviously, marijuana is still illegal at the federal level. And so, as a result, a lot of these dispensaries tend to be cash-intensive. They tend to have a lot of cash on hand. And we had a concern about smash-and-grab type robberies. We have had reports of those in Colorado and Washington. And so one of our concerns was, how do we target harden these facilities to dissuade people from potentially, you know, doing some kind of a takeover robbery. And so one of the things that we came up with was a mandatory buzz-in door locking system for the external door, just as a way of giving the folks inside a little bit more security and dissuading people that might otherwise try and break into the facility. Our third recommendation was to require the dispensaries to have a current alarm permit through the system. Currently, state law requires the dispensaries to have an active alarm and to have it monitored. We think it's very reasonable to have that alarm permitted through the city so that we can ensure that it's working properly and that they get a proper police response if there's a call there. In addition, if we have chronic false alarms, then that's something that we can work with the establishment on. So we thought that was important as well. And then lastly, and this is probably one of the biggest recommendations, and it gets to this issue of the revolving door, is we thought that it was important to limit the number of times a day that a patient could access medical marijuana from a facility. Current law allows a patient to possess 24 ounces of usable marijuana, and the subcommittee's feeling was that that was enough for one day, and that the subcommittee recommends that a patient be allowed to access a medical marijuana facility one time. As a practical nature, and I know the question came up, we understand that this is difficult to track. There is no tracking system currently in place that ties all of these dispensaries together. Even at the state level for prescription drugs, that's a voluntary system. So again, as a practical matter, there's not an easy way to track that. However, if we have the sales system in place, the inventory tracking system that the subcommittee is advocating, then we know how many times a patient is going in to access marijuana. Those are records that we can take a look at, and if we have a problem with a particular establishment where we're seeing that revolving door, then that's something that we can address. We understand that there's nothing that prevents a patient from going to one dispensary to access 24 ounces of marijuana and then going to another dispensary on some other part of the city. That's going to be difficult to control at this point.
We could potentially have a local ordinance limiting it to 24 or whatever the number is. Here and then, if the dispensaries were tracking, we could see if there was a problem. We could see if a patient had been going around to multiple different ones.
Correct. Yeah.
So it would be
at least it's a place to start, and that was the subcommittee's feeling.
Right, and also limiting the any one dispensary from doing it over and over again. That would be the burden would be on that dispensary.
Correct.
Yeah, that sounds like a good
correct.
Plan.
So aside from the practicalities like that one. Are you all confident that we have or will have the regulatory authority to do these four things? In other words, will we need the legislature to confer any of this authority on us, or do we already have it and or it comes with the ballot measure?
Mayor, it's a little bit of a hodgepodge. Some of these we do believe we have the authority, particularly around extra security on the facilities themselves. When it comes to regulating the medical marijuana statutes, I'm not entirely convinced that we do have that authority without legislative action. And that's why we need a little bit more time to prepare recommendations for a legislative agenda.
What other cash businesses in our community do we regulate out of concern for what someone might do in trying to get the cash? I mean, when I get into a cab, there's usually a sign saying driver is only carrying a limited amount of cash. There's ways in which traditional cash businesses insulate themselves from this problem. But are there other examples where we as a city regulate things like access as a way of getting at the problem?
I'm not aware of any other business that we currently regulate in that fashion. But I think that having said that, this is a bit of a unique animal in the amount of cash that we're talking about. And also, in addition to just the cash aspect, you also have obviously the product on hand. So there are multiple motivating factors for somebody to hit one of these places in a strong arm robbery type fashion. And I think if you look at some of the other kind of cash-intensive businesses, banks or things of that nature, they have done a lot of things to target harden their facilities, too. They haven't been mandated, haven't been regulated, but they've certainly, you know, addressed those as a way of strengthening their facilities and dissuading people that might, you know, otherwise be tempted to rob them.
Commissioner, found out many fascinating things through the course of this exercise, one of which was much like the much maligned U.S. Secret Service through Treasury, our Revenue Bureau actually does regulate pawn shops. So Thomas can speak to the extent that we do regulate those businesses.
Good morning. I'm Thomas Lanham with the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services. We do regulate secondhand dealers, pawn shops, and I'm not aware of any additional requirements that we have in terms of access around, you know, a cash-intensive business like that one.
I have a question, a naive question, about the relationship of medical marijuana to just regular prescription drugs. I mean, I've assumed that the way prescription drugs work is, you know, a physician writes a prescription for a specific amount and sends that prescription to a particular drugstore, and that's the only way that you get your prescription filled. Why does it not work that way with medical marijuana, and could it?
Well, I'm going to make an assumption here. There's a significant difference between the way regular prescription drugs work and medical marijuana in that regular prescription drugs are regulated by the federal government, whereas medical marijuana is not. And so medical marijuana is regulated by our current state statute, which simply allows a patient to have a certain amount of usable marijuana in their possession, if that makes sense. And the way to access that usable marijuana is either to have a grower that grows it on behalf of you, or have a caregiver that accesses it on behalf of you, or to grow that product yourself, or now currently under the current state law to go to a dispensary and have an active Oregon medical marijuana patient card and be able to access it at a dispensary.
So it sounds like we are being forced to think about constructing an elaborate enforcement mechanism because the state won't simply take on the responsibility of regulating marijuana as if it's a prescription drug.
I think it's fair to say there's some loopholes at the state level. And really that was the concern of this committee in general, is how do we address some of those gray areas?
And Commissioner, I think hearkening back to what Andy had said at the beginning, I do believe the legislature will have a vigorous debate moving forward in the next session on a bunch of those issues as well.
So Josh, just to put it in context, the one-year moratorium was put in there precisely because of all these unanswered questions about how this is going to function, who regulates, how you pay for it, et cetera. So the one-year moratorium would give some cities and localities a chance to figure it out before it actually put it in place.
Correct.
Okay.
Thanks, guys. Next, we have the wonderful Stephanie Reynolds presenting on the Subcommittee on Preventing Recreational Use of Marijuana by Minors.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Nice to be with you here today. I'm representing the subcommittee that looked at preventing recreational use of marijuana by minors. And I think it is mostly common knowledge that at this point that brains continue their development until about age 25. That's been widely reported, and I think it's something that more and more people are becoming aware of. Early onset use of marijuana and heavy use of marijuana in young people have both been shown to negatively impact the brain, and those effects can persist into adulthood even with sustained abstinence from marijuana use. If you look at our handout that we provided you, the one on preventing recreational use of marijuana by minors, on that first page you'll see that early onset use is associated with attention deficits, reduced IQ, and reduced executive functioning. And heavy use among teens and young adults is associated with cognitive deficits in the areas of processing speed, memory, complex attention, inhibitory control, and psychomotor speed. You'll notice that at the back of this handout, we just have a whole raft of studies cited. And I really want to thank Sandra Storm from Multnomah County Health Department. She's a prevention specialist there, and she's actually here with us this morning. She was very helpful to us in helping us understand the effect of marijuana on young people. So the public field of public health has known for decades that behavioral health is affected by risk and protective factors. These are conditions that exist at an individual level, at a family level, at a community level, at a broad society level. And risk factors are, of course, those factors that are associated with worse health outcomes, and protective factors are associated with better health outcomes. And so what our committee is proposing to council is that we believe that marijuana should not be used by people whose brains are still developing, that we should do what we can to prevent that because that is a risk factor for young people, and that we should try to enact some things that will at least delay use of marijuana by people until their brains are done developing. So although the atmosphere with marijuana is rapidly changing, I think societal attitudes about it are rapidly changing, and it's becoming a more and more permissive atmosphere around marijuana. We don't know exactly what this increased permissiveness, what kind of effect it's going to have on young people and their usage levels. We don't know yet. We're starting to see some things out of Washington and Colorado, but we don't quite know yet what is going to be happening. But we think that we can take a page from the extensive research that's been done on alcohol and tobacco, which are also both substances that are potentially harmful for young people, that have really been extensively researched. So if you look again at your handout, at the last paragraph of that first page, you will see that we start citing studies about density of alcohol outlets and proximity of alcohol outlets. And there's a lot of evidence that indicates that the closer an alcohol outlet is to young people, the more likely they are to use alcohol. And the higher density of alcohol outlets in a place where young people live, the more likely they are to use alcohol. There's a very high correlation between those conditions and youth use of alcohol. The same thing is true of tobacco outlets. Young people who live in a place where there are more dense tobacco outlets are more likely to use tobacco. So in addition, it's been found that reduced exposure to images and messaging, encouraging use of substances is associated. It's a protective factor. There's lower use of alcohol and tobacco among young people who have reduced exposure to those kinds of images. So the recommendations that our subcommittee came up with are designed to reduce youth exposure to marijuana. And we have three recommendations that we'd like to make. The first one is that we'd like to suggest that we require a cap on the total number of facilities that can operate within the city of Portland. That would be for both medical dispensaries, and in the event that the ballot measure passes, it would also include retail outlets. In Clear Lake, California, they have enacted a maximum number of facilities of one facility per 5,000 residents. If we enacted a similar ratio here, that would be 122 dispensaries, marijuana dispensaries in the city of Portland. That's 1.3 on average per neighborhood, which seems like it would be adequate to meet the needs and desires of adult users without making it so ubiquitous that children would be exposed to it all the time.
But we don't regulate how many drugstores can be in a neighborhood. So I concur with, we know we've got problems with lots of alcohol establishments in some areas. So for the recreational side, I'm totally down with that. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to separate and have the dispensaries, allow more dispensaries for people who need that, because one per neighborhood could be over a mile walk.
I think that's potentially possible, Commissioner. The thing we want to guard against, though, would be, again, diversion into the medical program. If we make medical much more available than recreational would be, if it were to be legalized at some point, by making more areas or more dispensaries throughout neighborhoods. It would just be one factor to guard against.
Right. I think that's, again, where the legislature needs to be asked to step up to be more, to make dispensaries more like doctor's offices, and as Commissioner Novick was suggesting, prescription for a certain amount, for that amount. And that way, I mean, there could, if we then limited the number of recreational facilities, if you were a dispensary and happened to be under the cap, you could have one side for recreational, one side for medical. Otherwise, you should not have that option.
Thank you. Yes, and to be fair, we don't know exactly what this would look like should the ballot measure pass. We have no idea whether the outlets would be combined locations or whether they would be completely separate systems. We just don't know that yet.
I just want to make sure that patients who need medication can get it without having problems.
Sure.
Also, I have a question. What is shoulder tapping?
Oh, shoulder tapping is something that is one of the ways that young people get a hold of substances that are otherwise forbidden to them. So they stand, for example, outside of a liquor store, and they wait for an adult to drive up, and then they ask that person if they will please buy them alcohol, for example. They give them money. The adult goes into the store, buys the alcohol for the young person, and gives it to them.
I also do want to clarify that there are currently minors who do have valid medical marijuana cards for legitimate medical reasons. So just to be clear on that we're not saying we want to restrict that access either.
What's the effective date of the ballot measure, or are there multiple effective dates for different provisions within it?
So July 1 of 2016 is the effective date. 2016.
Yeah, so the measure itself takes effect 30 days after the election, and that in part is because it contains a tax measure, and there's a constitutional restriction on how soon on non-emergency revenue measures. So it complies with that constitutional provision. But as Thomas noted, the measure itself has some implementation dates, so it doesn't really go into effect. It gives some time for the OLCC to set up the regulatory structure that it's otherwise directed to do. And so the program itself won't actually go into effect until 2016.
So there's some time. I think I would like to actually skip over the second recommendation here and then come back to it, because I'm going to ask Joe Zender to come up here and talk to you about the maps that you have here. So if you skip over to our third recommendation, it would be to limit the hours of operation for dispensaries and retail facilities. Again, if you go back to our overall effort here, which is to try to make marijuana less ubiquitous in the environment for young people, thereby reducing the chances that they will be able to get a hold of it. We think that limiting the operation for dispensaries and retail facilities to something similar to what hard liquor stores have right now, which is typically about 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., that would allow enough hours in the day for adult shoppers to get what they need without having them be open, say, 24 hours a day, with the traffic that is associated with that. And then moving back to our second recommendation on this sheet, it would be to not expand the size of the buffer zones necessarily, but to expand the types of facilities that require a buffer zone around them. So Andy Smith earlier talked about where buffer zones are required. It's for schools of certain types and for dispensaries not to be within 1,000 feet of each other or at the same location as a grow site. We would like to suggest that the buffer zones be expanded to some additional youth-oriented facilities, such as perhaps playgrounds and libraries. And I'd like to invite Joe Zender to come up here and talk about the mapping that he's provided here.
And I will note that playgrounds actually are defined in state statute. We were trying to figure out, should it be all parks? How do you guard against the idea of areas that don't necessarily have parks in terms of an equity analysis? But the state actually does define playgrounds separately.
Actually, if I could interrupt, I misspoke earlier. So the measure is actually a little more complicated in terms of its effective date rollout. There are some provisions mainly pertaining to some tax issues and criminal statutes that will take effect immediately on December 4th. And then there's other aspects of it, mainly pertaining to the OLCC's responsibilities that will take effect July 1st, 2015, not 2016.
Are community centers already on the list of places?
So they might be. They might meet the definition of a playground, depending on what else is there.
Yeah, I don't believe they are considered within the definition of playground. So that would
so
be
that's something else to add, I would think. And also, correct. I've heard from constituents who educational facilities that don't meet the definition, state definition of school, but seem to be very school-like. We might want to add those. Yes.
Walk us through the maps. Could you just remind us? Is it 1,000 feet? As the crow flies, or is there some other way you can calculate the 1,000 feet?
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Joe Zunder, Chief Planner with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And the 1,000 feet, the way it's represented here, and actually the way I believe the Oregon Health Authority and my colleague from Portland Police Bureau is just a radius. So it's as the crow flies. You just pop a radius. What you're looking at here is a set of maps that we've just prepared that are sort of a tool to be able to evaluate the locations of the medical marijuana facilities and how different layers, how different objects we might want or different uses we might want to buffer them from affects the supply of land. So we're starting on the two-color page where it's got a dark green and a so the staple is going to be in the lower left-hand corner. It's a little not typical, but this is all the land where retail sales and service are allowed in the city. Some, the darker green or the lighter green or industrial areas that, you know, allow a little bit, but technically you could be a medical marijuana facility in there. And the stars show 60 locations or 63, I believe, locations of the medical marijuana facilities we know of today. And then as you go through the maps, each one takes buffers the medical marijuana facilities from a different use. So if you go to the third map, which is the first one that has the red stars on it, and it's areas within 1,000 feet of a public or private K-12 school, you can see how this system, this application works, where it's reducing the amount of land area that's even possibly eligible for a medical marijuana facility and popping up some areas that we need to go, or some dispensaries we need to look at more closely to see if they're actually within 1,000 feet of a school. The definition of the school in our system and how Oregon Health Authority does it is a little bit different. And so for each one of these that are popping up as a red star here, which says that when we applied the layer of 1,000 feet from the schools, these are within 1,000 feet from a school. We would need to go back and confirm each of those with our Portland Police Bureau colleague and with OHA. But that's how this sort of application works. The red stars show you which ones turn up within 1,000 feet of whatever you're trying to buffer from. And also, the reason we prepared this also is in anticipation of being able to analyze where marijuana dispensaries, period, medical or otherwise, start to take place across the city to assure ourselves that they're not being concentrated in any particular neighborhood, be it related to income, communities of color, just sort of there's an equity distribution that we can take a look at eventually here too. Next page. This adds in 1,000 feet within a playground, and basically compared to the school layer, this just adds one dispensary. So by buffering the playgrounds the way we're defined and the way they're mapped in the city of Portland, it's still, we believe that part of what you always have to think about when you're choosing which things to buffer from, is there a nexus between that use and substantial exposure of youth to marijuana use. So that's the basis on which we would make a land use decision. Playgrounds were the first one we added, and it takes out one more location. Yes.
So just following up on your comments about the equity distributions, that they're not concentrated in any one area. If we're talking about medical marijuana, there's an equity issue where people in North Portland and outer southeast and perhaps some areas of southwest can't get to a medical marijuana dispensary.
And so this allows you to see the land that's at least possible out there, Commissioner, too, for the location of a dispensary, although they haven't been necessarily yet.
Right, but it's a different...
It works both ways.
It works both ways, and it's different for recreational versus medical. So I'm going to keep saying both of those things quite a lot.
Yep. Third layer adds in libraries. And again, it really picks up one more dispensary, Kenton Public